Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks on Mondays, to new developments in the world of COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I wanted to start with the fallout from the government shutdown. Some of the dashboards that I refer to periodically, and I'm sure you do as well, that are maintained by the CDC, have been put on pause. There is not new data getting collated and put into, for instance, their dashboard on sewer water monitoring for levels of viral, I guess they're looking for viral RNA. How big an impact in the public health world is there from the government shutdown?
Well, in the short run, not a great deal. It's frustrating not to be able to follow in more real time what's happening, not just with COVID, but with influenza and RSV, since we're entering the season for those two viruses. But as it drags on, we're getting further and further behind the pandemic, behind what's going to be happening this fall with respiratory viruses. What that translates to is that the advice you'll get from people like me, from you, from all the sources we have, is really not going to be quite as accurate. And it's going to get less and less accurate over time. And that advice becomes really important because it guides people in terms of how to protect themselves. Bottom line, Brian, it's just a denigration of the public's health, not public health as much as the public's health.
Now, a lot of people in public health had already been concerned about the reliability of data from the CDC, either that it could be, you know, abruptly taken offline by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., or politicized, or the staff maintaining it could be cut by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. So there were already a lot of efforts underway to set up redundant data gathering and reporting infrastructure, right?
Sure. If we look at an organization like the CDC, which at the time that RFK Jr. came into power in middle of February of this year, there were a little over 11,400 employees there. Beginning last Friday, just a few days ago, there were roughly about 10% were fired. And now they're scrambling to hire back some of these folks. And this is on top of financial cuts that have taken place over the last several months as well. And this is on top of a gunman trying to kill CDC employees. So you can imagine how functional an organization is going to be after the insults that it's received. Now, I'm not saying that there couldn't be a more efficient CDC. There couldn't be a better communicating CDC. Of course there could be. And sometimes cuts make sense, but to be done indiscriminately and to be done almost viciously is bizarre at best. And again, comes back to why does the CDC exist at all? And the reason why is because it greatly improves the health of our public. It greatly in here improves everyone's health and decision-making. So it's been really just devastating, Brian. And who knows where this is going to stop. Clearly, the trajectory suggests that there's a concerted effort to destroy that organization.
All right. I want to reserve the bulk of our time this morning for phone calls, since we haven't been able to take them for the past couple weeks. That number is 1-800-958-9008 to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg. That is 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. In the inbox, we had several questions running into today's segment about timing the flu shot, when it is optimal to get vaccinated for influenza this year. Maybe we could start with the basics. What do we know about how effective this year's shot is against the strains currently in circulation?
We know from the experience that the Southern Hemisphere had, now that they're coming out of their winter and their influenza season, and it's looking generally like the influenza vaccine is going to protect against hospitalization and death by about 50%. It'll reduce that risk by about 50%. Now, of course, we'd like it at 90%, but I'll take 50% any day in terms of a reduction in the chances of my getting hospitalized or dying from influenza. The interesting data tucked into that is that it looks like the high-dose vaccine, there are actually three different brands, but the high-dose vaccine may protect even a little more than 50% in older people, which is where the greatest morbidity and mortality in a population lies. So I think we're at an average year for the efficacy of the influenza vaccine. That's where we are in terms of efficacy. And I think we can pretty accurately abstract from what happened in the summer in the Southern Hemisphere to what we can anticipate here. Now, in terms of timing, that's like timing the stock market. No one knows for sure, but the kinds of things that I think about in making a decision relate to the recognition that anywhere from 4 to 8% of the antibody response you get is lost roughly every 4 weeks after the first 2 weeks of your vaccine. So if you got vaccinated today, then you get peak vaccines, antibody levels in about 2 weeks. And then you'd lose about 4 to 8% each month. And then the second factor that ties with that is influenza is really quite predictable, unlike COVID. And influenza typically visits our community, our latitude, right around Thanksgiving time. And we're seeing cases now, but we're not seeing very many. But we'll start to see more and more and more as we get into toward the end of November. And then it will continue to rise and typically will peak in late January, maybe mid-January, and sometimes up to mid-February the peak occurs. And then it drops precipitously, and by the end of March, it's pretty much gone. Again, sporadic cases will occur throughout the year, but the real impact of influenza is pretty much gone. So if you add those two things together, it tells us that we'd really want to have our maximum protection, our really good protection, at a time when influenza is going to be visiting us. But we don't want to get it too soon, because then we'll lose it. So those are the two things that I use to calculate when I should get it. And I'm going to throw in a third thing just to make it more complicated, and that is look and see what's on your schedule. If you're going to be traveling somewhere, or if you're going to a large indoor occasion where you're going to be with lots of people, if there's something happening in your life that you really want to be protected for, let's say you're going to be having surgery and in a couple weeks, and you really want to have maximum protection at that time. Those are things that would help tilt the decision one way or another in terms of when to get vaccinated. So bottom line, now is a good time to get vaccinated. Up till maybe, we're not seeing a lot of influenza, as I said, so maybe up until the first week of November would make sense, unless we start to see a lot next week or the week after that. But of course, as we were earlier talking about, Brian, we're not getting really good information now, or as good as we should be getting in terms of helping us decide that, in terms of what influenza is doing. Frustrating. So bottom line, and now is a good time. Next week's a good time. The week after that's a good time. And if you start to push it out into mid-November, you're taking your chances in terms of getting the flu.
All right. Let's go to some of our listener question. First up is Aid right here in Berkeley. Good morning.
Hello? Hello?
You're on the air. What's your question?
Okay. I'd like to ask the doctor if you share my big concern about H5N1 bird flu. The only one mutation away from being airborne, it has over 50% lethal or mortality rate. That can be terrible. And right now, especially with the current administration that against vaccine, we're talking about 50% of the country dying, you know. So we have to really pay attention to that. Also like to say that the both Pfizer vaccine and Moderna were invented or, you know, came to our life by immigrants. Moderna by Lebanese American and Pfizer by Greek American. And also, the last thing I want to mention, over 1.2 million Americans died unnecessarily from COVID-19 because of Donald Trump's denial of the virus, while most countries had deaths in the tens of thousands. Thank you. That's my question.
All right, Dr. Swartzberg, let's focus on the public health issue in there at present, which is the risk of bird flu mutating into something that would pose a threat to public health. How far are we away from that kind of breakout?
We don't know. The virus H5N1 influenza can mutate, does mutate, and we don't know whether it's going to change in a way that allows it to easily infect human beings. That's a big question mark. As the caller points out, the virus itself, in the few humans that have been infected with it, carries a very significant mortality rate. Probably it's reported at roughly 50%, but we know that as new viruses are introduced into the human population, the mortality rates initially are quite high for a variety of reasons, and then they drop pretty precipitously. For example, SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, had a mortality rate early on of maybe 5%, and it dropped precipitously to now about less than 0.7%. So it regardless, a 50% mortality would just completely disrupt the world.
Right. That I think that's worth drilling down into, because this has come up every time we've covered the threat of a new infectious disease. I don't want us to be like super alarmist. 1 or 2% mortality with something that's highly contagious would be world altering. But you get these higher mortality rates in the official statistics when something is new because there's not much testing. They are only identifying it in people who present to healthcare facilities that already have severe symptoms. That's why it tends to drop as a disease becomes more widespread and a broader cross-section of the population is getting tested. You start catching more of the milder cases. But again, much less than 50% would still be of massive concern.
Sure, but thank you for explaining that. Put that in perspective, the great influenza pandemic of 1918-1919 spilling into 1920, which killed about a third of the, killed an enormous number of Americans, and worldwide it killed maybe 50, 75 million people. That had a mortality rate of 2, 3, 4, maybe 5%. So you can imagine what a 50% mortality, I can't imagine what a 50% mortality would be. Regardless, the point is that as the caller made, that is we're not paying attention to this virus. You don't read much about it anymore. It's lost its cachet in the news, but more importantly, it's lost its investigation by organizations like the CDC to a large extent. We are seeing after the last spring, we saw the cases of H5N1 in bird flocks and in cattle drop a lot, probably because it's seasonal. And in the last month, we've been seeing cases pick up again. So it'll be very important to watch what this virus does. And then also what the caller, I think I understood him to say, mentioned about the vaccine. Much of that funding was cut by RFK Jr. in the spring. So we're positioning ourselves for a catastrophe, maybe with H5N1, but maybe with a different influenza virus or maybe with a different coronavirus. Who knows? We're not putting the effort in to prevent these things. And let me just say one last thing about that.
Sure.
And that's the Office of Pandemic Preparedness that Congress funded doesn't exist. There's nobody in charge of it. There are no employees of it. It's part of the executive branch, and Trump has just let it die. So we don't even have an Office of Pandemic Preparedness.
I guess something else we should clarify, and my memory is a little fuzzy on this, but the strain of H5N1 of bird flu that was moving through dairy herds and making news when it occasionally jumped into people who work closely with cows seemed to be mostly producing mild illness. It was distinct from a strain that on occasion people have caught directly from birds and gotten very sick from.
Right. The 50% mortality rate numbers really come from data over the last close to 30 years now in looking at this virus, and it's worldwide data. So again, like you pointed out nicely, Brian, wouldn't pay a lot of attention to that number, but I think we can just say that this is a virulent virus.
All right, next question we'll pluck from the inbox. Cornelius is in San Francisco. He asks, Dr. Swartzberg has advocated taking Paxlovid for those over 60 who contract COVID. Recently, however, I'm hearing from friends suggesting that letting the virus play itself out instead of intervening with Paxlovid is being recommended, especially for mild cases. What does Dr. Swartzberg think?
I think that's wrong. If you're in a high-risk group and 65 or over is considered a high-risk group, if you're younger than that but have diabetes, obesity, lung problems, heart problems, et cetera, you're in a high-risk group. What that translates to is that you're in a higher risk of getting really sick from the virus and getting hospitalized, being on a ventilator, and dying. So I think that's not good advice. We know that Paxlovid will reduce the duration of your symptoms and does reduce the risks of the virus, both in terms of acute COVID, as well as perhaps, still some question marks attached with that, but perhaps long COVID. another word of caution is this idea that let your body just develop immunity to it and you'll be better off. There's no evidence to suggest that at all. Would you do that if you had a bacterial infection and let's say you had a strep throat and you wouldn't take an antibiotic for that? You develop fine immunity. Your body will develop immunity once it's insulted by the virus or bacterium. You don't need to get really sick to have a better immunity. There's concern that people have about a higher risk of having a relapse if you take Paxlovid. We don't know if that's true or not. Much of the data suggests that it's not true, but there is some data that suggests it may be true. But relapses are almost invariably less severe or at the worst about the same as your original event. And if there is a higher risk, it's not much over just relapsing if you've had COVID, which occurs close to 20% of the time. So I don't see a good reason to not take it, Paxlovid, and I see a lot of good reasons to take it. Let me just say one other caveat, and that is early on with COVID, the symptoms are due to the virus replicating in our respiratory tree, our nose, throat, airways, and our immune system starting to react to that. Symptoms are often mild for the first few days. What sends people to the hospital is an overwhelming inflammatory response that typically begins on day 6, 7, 8 after you've been infected And that's when people crash. That's when they really get sick and need help. There's no good way of predicting that based upon how you're doing on day one, two, and three, and four. So waiting till you get really sick means that Paxlovid will be less effective because it's most effective the earlier you take it. And waiting till you get really sick is going to wind you up in the hospital. So I hear this mistake being made very frequently by some physicians and certainly those infected. And that is, oh, it's just a really mild case. I'm not going to do anything about it. If I was sicker, I would take something for it. Well, by the time you're sicker, it may be too late.
You don't know it's a mild case or not until it's too late to take Paxlovid.
Potentially, that's right. So I would not base my decision on whether or not to take it on how a patient's doing at that moment in time. Certainly, if they're really sick, that makes it a very easy decision. But it's still an easy decision if you're in a high-risk group and you've got documented COVID. Take it as early as possible in the course.
Right. Reasons to not take it might be interactions with other drugs you're on that you need to stay on for your
Absolutely.
Own health. There's a limited number of cases. So, you know, it requires a prescription. It requires someone taking your medical history and knowing what else they're dealing with. But I think I've got a mild case, never a good rationale.
Right. And another reason that people don't take it is they may not have the insurance coverage for it, which is just a terrible reason. I mean, I understand it. And I've heard pharmacies charging $600, $800, $1,200, $1,300 for a course of 5 days of Paxlovid.
That's state of the American healthcare system is kind of depressing. Let's try to squeeze in one more caller quickly. John is on the phone in the North Bay area. Good morning, John.
Hi. Thanks for your show. KPFA is a blessing. I was wondering, is there any evidence that the bird flu has, I heard that it has reached wild populations of birds. Is it possible it could get into cats, even domestic cats? Thank you.
The answer is yes. You're absolutely right, John. The bird flu virus is really a misnomer. It's a virus that infects lots of different animals. So lots of different birds, but also different mammals. So there's a reservoir for that. And unfortunately, cats appear to be much more susceptible to getting infected with H5N1 than dogs. We've seen we've seen cases in cats who live around dairies where they probably got it from drinking the milk. We've seen cats getting it from eating raw food that families have given them, which is a real no-no, but that's the way we've seen cats get it. And it carries a significant mortality rate in cats.
Even the little furry companions are not exempt. All right, Dr. Swartzberg, we should leave it there for this week. Thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.